morning cues, it's so much fun.
I don't know about you, 99, or all the unfuckers out there, but I'm having a lot of conversations lately. I seem to be falling into conversations about the student protests and the nature of anti-Semitism. And I'm trying to figure out, and I'm actually perplexed by some of the beliefs that I don't want to say that I'm challenging back, but just, you know, in my day-to-day conversations, I try to be as open and warm and loving as I can be, just, you know, as I try to be when I'm writing on the pod. And I'm trying to figure out if it's a reflection of my geography and demography. If, because I associate with people from New York of a particular age, if I'm running into more headwinds on these two issues than I might otherwise in other parts of the country and in other age groups. I imagine so, but at the same time, you know, your experience and your perception is your reality. And so specifically, I'm running into a lot of people who would be, I think would characterize themselves as, you know, small D Democrats, like liberal establishment type MSNBC Democrats, let's say, who are virulently against the campus protests in a way that's surprising and in a way that I can't seem to penetrate with rational arguments in a way that I normally find at least a modicum of success. I'm just running into pure resistance. And I think some of that, if not most of it, is correlated heavily with people's feelings regarding the anti-Semitic perceived nature of the protests. So I'm wondering, are these organic conversations happening around you as much as they are with me?
Yes and no. I probably see less people in my life day to day than you.
You think?
Yes, just by the nature of you do things with your kids and you talk to other parents. I have a specific friend group that I talk to regularly. And then I have other friends who, when I see them, I don't always know where they fall. You know, I know they're, for the most part, Democratic. I wouldn't necessarily say liberal, all of them, but they're not, you know, racists or anything like that. But I'm not going to be like, what do you think about this? Because.
But do they bring it up? Do you find people are leaning and seemingly wanting to have these conversations?
Some of my friends are a bunch of doofuses and they don't care. They don't want to talk politics ever. So, you know, as long as I don't find them to be hateful people, it doesn't bother me so much, seeing as they're not the people I spend all the time with. But yeah, I mean, I talk about it with my roommate all the time. You know, we're always talking about it. I did have a conversation with a boomer recently who is a Jewish boomer and, you know, had some very strong feelings on the protests that A, they do nothing. B.
Was it a conversation or a lecture?
I was trying to make it a conversation and not an argument. Mm-hmm. We'll say it that way. More of it was a dialogue, but the protesters are ruining their lives. Gonna get arrested. They're ruining their futures. Protesting does nothing. You know, the fact that I, as an also Jewish person, are pro the protests and pro Palestine makes me anti-Jew. You know, all the talking points, and I bring things up over and over again. Like, you know, what about the protests for Vietnam? You think those did nothing? Yes, they did nothing. That was the answer. So, you know, talking about Kent State. Sort of almost veering into victim blaming territory. Like if something happens to them, it's their fault because they should know what happens, you know, not, hey, maybe it's the fault of the people who are shooting, not the people who are protesting. Crazy idea, bananas idea. But yeah, so that was the most diversity of thought conversation I had because, I mean, again, me and my roommate are on, we have differences of opinions. We're not homogenous, even though when we talk about ourselves, we do talk about ourselves as a we, which is a problem. But, you know, we're following local protests, things like that, seeing what's going on. But yeah, I guess not as much as you would think. Maybe I'm a bad progressive that I don't hang out with circles of progressives and debate ideologies.
No, I don't really have any progressive friends, if I'm being honest.
You don't have any friends.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't going to extrapolate that any further than necessary, you know, but sure. Yeah, like, you know, I walked into a coffee shop this week and in the middle of, and there were three people that I knew and they were engaged in conversation about campus protests. And right away it was like, well, where do you stand? And I was just like, I just gotta grab my coffee and I'm good. And I actually, ironically, the person holding court was very much in favor of the student protest because her daughter was attending and in an encampment. And the only way that she could really communicate with her was by watching her Instagram story.
If she had a, what, why is that?
Her daughter was just like, I'm doing this. I'm just sort of like shutting off all communications.
I just wasn't sure if there was something else going on because that didn't make any sense. If she has access to internet for Instagram,
she just like wasn't like calling her directly and like, you know, giving her like live updates. So she's like, I'm sitting here, I'm just like getting updates from her Instagram, you know, until I can like, you know, have a real conversation with her. But it's kind of like a batshit environment right now. And the other two people were sort of quiet. The power dynamics in that conversation were such that the person holding court would probably be just running roughshod over anybody else's opinions anyway.
Because they're right or because of their personality?
Personality-wise,
okay,
yeah.
Just curious.
And then a couple of other, you know, instances where it was like,
more
man,
coffee
I just
shops you walked into. People
can't avoid this.
There.
One very directly of people that wanted to get together because they're like, I want to work through this with you because you're wrong, kind of like stance. Like, okay,
that's
great.
That's an interesting thing. Please come over. I want to tell you how you're wrong.
Yeah.
Not like I want to understand. I want to tell you you're wrong.
And it was a heartfelt appeal from people that I care about very, very deeply. They're very important to me. But I was finding that my normal pathways for having these type of conversations were unsuccessful. So my question for the unfuckers is, what are the conversations like by you? Do you find them age specific, demographic specific? Do you find people are afraid to talk about it? Do you find that people are actually like too comfortable talking about it? Like, I'm wondering what the conversations elsewhere sound like. One of the things I'm more aware of since I started the podcast is my bubble, and not just my information bubble, because I'm pretty disciplined about trying to find information outside of my bubble, but outside of my bubble butt. How about that? Outside of my bubble. But, you know, this one's hard because it's you do, like you said before, you know, you have your kids, you have your established group, your community, people you came up with, and now as my kids are older and we're having to sort of like resettle into these groups where it's not just like, what are the kids doing today? What are they doing tomorrow? You know, your life for like a decade was just about plans. What's next? What's happening? Who's doing what? What are we doing for this person? And you're moving from one event to the other. And now we're coming to this phase of our life where it's like, oh, wow, we have like days and days, like stretches of days where it's just like, okay, we're close to like, we're a second away from being empty nesters. And it's almost like you have to re-enter the atmosphere. It's a really curious time to do that. Like people developed some pretty fucking strong opinions over the last few years. And it's unsettling.
Yeah. The world, I mean, we're never going to go back to a polite society in any form. We can talk about whatever we want now because we should.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously there's a time and a place. There's being respectful. You're not going to walk into a church and during a service and be like, you know, fuck all of you. That's not respectful, but you can talk about religion in public these days. It's not like never talk about, what was it? What are the things? Religion.
Politics.
Sex, salary. Right? Salary. Money.
Salary. Sex. Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. You know. So I think we're past those days. But no, I think what you're saying about the bubble is super interesting because it is really hard to tell, especially because we're, you know, being in New York with the numbers that you gave the other day, what was up? What was it? 54 schools.
Yep.
So you know, and a handful of them are here, and then the rest are scattered across the whole country. Right. So we're right in the heart of it. And, you know, I mean, I know the news is national.
You get the double dip of the national and local
and
news.
Local news, yeah. And just people you know. So you're not everyone's going to know somebody who has a kid who's protesting.
Yeah.
Also, you have kids who, like, one of your kids is in college right now. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going on at her school, but there, you know, there could be protests there. So, you know, I think you're inside of it a little differently than me and my, you know, friends in our 30s who are like completely divorced from that world. Unless you're in it politically, you're not thinking about this type of thing unless it's disrupting your life. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's really annoying working in the city right now. I can imagine. I worked in the city during some turbulent times during the 2016 election. So there was like stuff happening all the time. And I don't mean that our city inconveniences by any measure are worse than what people are going through. Yep. But, you know, people, you have to realize that people are just focused on their, I got to go to work. I got to get home to my kids. I got to feed them. I got to go back to work tomorrow. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, not everyone can focus on it. So there's just so many different levels. At the
same time, I lived in the city for years and never went to Columbia's campus. Like it's not something you would, it wasn't in the part of the city that I'm in. And the city is such a diverse place. And, you know, so many areas you just don't think about going, you know?
Yeah. And I guess I'm extrapolating from the campus protests are, you know, attracting non-students as well. Mm-hmm. And I also think they're inspiring or just continuing people, their motivation to have other protests. So like there was a protest in Union Square the other day. There was a protest. They protested again across the street from the Met during the Met Gala. So, you know, people's everyday lives, if you work at the Met, like your life's probably going to, well, it was disrupted because of the stupid Met Gala anyway. Sorry, I don't know. I didn't mean to say stupid. You know, I meant that as throwaway. I think it's good to raise money for museums. I think that's fair.
It's fine.
I just think it's ironic that the theme was like earth and gardens and sustainability. And everyone's like, this is my dress that, you know, it took 7,000 hours to make and I probably flew here and blah, blah, blah. So that was my take on it. Did I watch the red carpet? Yeah, because my roommate did.
The feeling I had during Occupy, so I think I've said before that I was one of the earliest people in media to be in Occupy. And a lot of that, some of that was happenstance. But then once I kind of caught wind of it was day three and I just stayed there and I reported on it to its bitter conclusion. And one of the things that really struck me was, I give you two examples. One was when I was there in Zuccotti, it felt like this was happening everywhere. I was like, oh my, this is fucking amazing. It's pandemonium. It's a whole world. And then I would go home and it was like, is it still on? Is it still happening? So
you could go probably a few blocks away and it would feel like that.
A block. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And then the other part of it though was, this was at the time I was sending out updates on Facebook, because that's what we had. And people were contacting me left and right. Are you okay? Is it going to be okay? Is the world coming to an end? What's going on? And these are people that were so far removed from it, but we're looking at the breathless coverage of it once it hit the mainstream media and once it became identified as like a dangerous counterculture youth movement of people that just wanted to destroy the pillars of democracy and capitalism and tear down the walls. They're like, are you safe? Are you okay? I felt, up until the white shirts came in and took over the blue shirts, I felt safer there maybe than any other place or time that I had felt safe. It was like, it was an amazing place. It just shows like how the media can really craft your perception of a moment, because people from outside felt like the city as a whole was on fire. It was just, it's all going to come crumbling down. And I was like, wow, this is, it was a lesson for me in just in like trying to really focus on getting the right story out of there, because it was so easy to get swept up in whatever the prevailing narrative was, you know?
I think the biggest difference this time, obviously the media is not getting it right, but I don't think the protests are safe for the protesters.
No.
Based on the force that's being used. So while that might have been, you know, peaceful and hippie at first, all communal and whatever, like, this is not that. This is more like a war zone comparatively.
Yeah, I mean, so, one of the conversations I had was about, like, safety and the perception of, like, who's actually being violent and who's at risk is so interesting depending upon where you get your source.
And I don't even mean from the other, I mean from the police. I think there's a minimal amount of people who are violent. There always are. Mm-hmm. People are going to suck. People are going to be bad. Look around your life. You know a shitty guy. That shitty guy might end up in a protest.
Yeah.
But I was talking about it and I was saying, you know, about protesting and, you know, if I were to go to one, let's say, my friend was like, you know, I don't want to get arrested. And I was like, that's so low on my list of fears. I don't want to get, like, trampled. I don't want to get assaulted by an officer. Like, that's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of that type of violence. Like, if I got arrested, what would happen to me? Nothing. Because I'm a white person, thankfully. Nope. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean it like that. That's bad. I meant, thankfully, nothing will happen to me. Is this bad? Am I digging a hole? What do I do?
You went from... You covered so many different shades of red.
Because I just said the inside thing.
Seconds.
I said the inside thing. I didn't mean to say thankfully like that.
Right.
I meant like, thankfully nothing will happen
to
me.
Do not cut this.
No.
This is amazing.
No. I can feel it still happening.
Everybody understands.
Do they?
Yes.
Yes. Don't misconstrue me. I don't mean thankfully I'm white like a white supremacist. I mean, thankfully nothing would happen to me.
Manny's going to tell you stop banging the table.
Stop banging the table.
Also.
No, it shows you that I mean it. But yeah, nothing would happen to me. So that's low on my list of fears. I don't want to be the accidental racist by Brad Paisley and LL Cool J. That's a song.
Okay.
It's a song about he was wearing a Leonard Skinner shirt in a Starbucks. And the black barista was like, that's fucked up. Like, why are you wearing the Confederate flag? And then he realized, like, oh, this is racist because I'm supporting the Confederacy. I was just trying to throw off a band I like, but I didn't mean to be racist, but I was, and now I get it. And here's my black friend. He's also going to rap. there's a line in it that, hold on.
That's
I know this is a tangent, but I think this one is worthwhile.
That's
amazing. If we haven't talked about it before somehow. Man, what is the line that he says is unreal? Okay, so it's interspersed. It's the chorus. So Brad Pitt is going, I'm just a white man coming to you from my Southland. And LL Cool J goes, if you don't judge my do-rag, I won't judge your red flag.
That's a pretty tough verse.
Yeah. But yes, I didn't mean to be that person who's like,
understood.
I'm white and I'm better. I didn't mean it.
Understood.
I'm upset. I'm going to have a bad day now.
Understood.
Okay, well, yes, it's unsafe. Unsafe.
Also recorded to be clipped, edited into your rant about murdering 75-year-olds. We're putting it together basically just to
show that one. I don't,
what need, a monster you are.
You don't need to clip that. I'll just do it off the cuff again.
So
except Bernie, he is running for another term. Are you upset about that? I think he's still competent. I think we should hold on to the competent ones we have. I know that it might be hypocritical because we don't want Biden and Trump to retire because they're old. That's not the sole reason. It's what happened to them because they're old. If you still have your faculties when you're old, why not use them? That's what I'll say.
There's only 100 of them. They're precious.
That's one Bernie.
They're precious spots. And I can make the case for or against it. I see Bernie at this point, has elevated, I think, in the national consciousness, beyond a vote, beyond a senator, and as more of a statesman, really, and who can enjoy a post-public service life in a way to advocate for things, maybe in a way that's even bigger than what he does right now. And also, the need to develop a strong progressive bench has never been more important. So if it was Congress, okay, it's 2 years, I can handle that. This is 6 years. And, you know, I don't know. So maybe he decides to retire during his term. It could totally happen. But a handpicked progressive successor with Bernie saying, this is my person, I think would have been really powerful as he moves into the more statesman, you know, part of his career.
But if that person's not ready yet, we can't lose the seat. And that might be probably the reality of the situation. Like, person's not established enough for, you know, in whatever local something politics. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and that's the thing. I don't know what the composition of Congress people looks like in Vermont specifically.
Even non-Congress people.
Or state legislatures, legislators who are really competent, or somebody that's occupied maybe a high up position in the governor's office or whatever. But there have to be other really capable progressive politicians in the state of Vermont that should have been being groomed the entire time.
Right.
I mean, this is a lot of the criticism of Obama, for example, is that his bench was really short, very narrow. And not that, you know, I'm advocating for more of Obama's policies or that type of coastal elite establishment thinking. But that was the criticism of him leaving. It's like, not only did you destroy so many of the
People's lives with drones?
Guardrails that the executive branch had with respect to Congress and being able to carry out military and actions and domestic surveillance. Because the overarching narrative back then, especially from the people at the early stages of like The Intercept, were saying, listen, you could be the greatest guy in the world. You're not king. You're not going to be here forever. So whatever you do today, imagine the worst case scenario of somebody in charge having the same levers of power. They're not going to exercise any discretion. As it turns out, there's an argument to be made that actually Trump exercised more discretion than Obama in that case. So it's kind of a counter argument to it. But at the same time, you don't want to reduce these checks and balances. So just as he was creating that, he also wasn't sort of backfilling with capable bureaucrats and legislators. Like, he's not responsible for the squad. The squad came later. The squad came in response to the Trump administration. But we should have been clearing the deck and clearing the way for squad-like progressive members the whole time. So that's my only point with Bernie, is like, we need more Bernie, and locking him in this box for another 6 years means the same Bernie, but continually diminished on the national stage from having a voice.
That's fair. You know? I guess we should do a deep dive and check out who's in Vermont.
Yeah.
So maybe there are some people there that we don't know about, but, you know, I'm making up scenarios in my head, but maybe he talked to them. Maybe he said, are you ready? I'll retire. Are you ready for this? And they said, no. Who knows? I mean, if he really has some sort of successor that we just don't know about between me and you, then
yeah,
I just want to see the best in him.
Me too, always.
The only thing we have right now,
out of the two scenarios that it was, like, either he retires and he becomes an even bigger figure, or he stays there and he's still awesome Bernie. Like, we're not losing, you know? Like, I think it's great. I just wonder if we're playing the long game and he's committed to it, has he reached the stature where he could be more effective outside of the party? That's the calculus people like Mitt Romney are making, right? Can I be more effective outside of this GOP nightmare?
I mean, the fact that he still has so many fans from his presidential race, I think, shows that he could be. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bernie subreddit is still quite active.
Yeah.
That's how I gauge all things in life, is by the subreddits.
Totally fair. We have a lot of great comments this week that I want to get to, but I also want to make sure that we call out we don't have any follow-up because it literally just dropped. It was a late drop for a phone a friend. So we don't have much response in the way of the interview that we just did with the executive director of Point of Pride, named Jeff Main. I don't know how you felt about the interview at the end of it, but Jeff has a way of, I mean, talk about meeting people where they are. I find him to be one of the most effective communicators. Hard stop. It could be any topic, you know, because we've known him for several years. In this position of advocacy, though, he's so clear-headed and empathetic in the way that he communicates about this that it's like, I honestly feel that he's the type of person that if you could introduce him personally in a room to every single person that is vehemently anti-transgender, problem solved. Like, he's just that good at what he does.
Yeah, he's a magnetic person.
He is. He is. So I hope people get a chance to listen to him and to sort of listen to me fumble through an otherwise good conversation.
I think you did a great job.
Yeah, I always wonder if I'm asking what's on people's minds. That's the pressure of doing Phone a Friends, is there's the stuff I'm interested in, and then you want to make sure that it's a proper reflection of how the audience feels.
Yeah, I mean, we had those discussions before the interview, wondering what angle to take because, you know, as I said, like, talking about trans athletes, it's tired in terms of there's more things going on. Mm-hmm. Talking about litter boxes, we get it, you know? Like, right. We get the culture war high points. I think, we'll never satisfy everybody because everybody's coming from someone is coming from day one, not knowing anything about, you know, anti-trans legislation or even trans people in general.
Right.
And then we have people who are deep in advocacy in our listenership. So we're never going to run the gamut of everyone's satisfaction. But I think it was a really good conversation, and Point of Pride is an amazing organization. We have Pride coming up in June, so I'm sure they'll be doing some fundraisers and, you know, maybe events. So check out Point of Pride. Check out their resource directory. They have an incredible list of other organizations that you can support that give access to trans people, I think, across the world, not just in America, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah.
I was surprised by that.
It really,
I said 122 countries. They've had some sort of impact or connection to.
Yeah. So when knowing Jeff and seeing how much it's grown, it's almost not unfathomable because, of course, he could do something so great. But, you know, when you know somebody and you see this like real world impact, it's moving.
Mm-hmm.
Millions of dollars raised for their TikTok-a-thon.
Yeah.
Millions.
Yeah.
And this is just a guy we know.
Yeah.
Like, he's a cool guy we happen to know that does an amazing thing. So please listen and please support Point of Pride.
Yeah. And more than anything, and this is my personal take on it, what I take from conversations like that with people like Jeff is a true lesson in how to elevate the discourse. He's just, as I think 99 just put it perfectly, he's just magnetic. I mean, he really is. You want to be in conversation and in partnership with somebody like that. And it really is a lesson.
And if any of you work.
If you have a job.
The end of the sentence.
Oh, it's a good, yeah. Good.
If you work in an organization that is interested in bringing, you know, trainings or talks, we had Jeff do a presentation at our organization to show us what Point of Pride, you know, how in the workplace you can, you know, support your trans colleagues, get involved, things like that. So they're available to do those too, which I think is really interesting. Even if you're in, you know, I know some of our members are in, I don't want to call them like little groups because that feels dismissive, but kind of like progressive groups that, you know, meet and talk on their local levels. So even something like that, I think it would be a great use case.
Without a doubt.
Could just play our podcast and listen together.
Jeff also dropped a resource that 99 went back and surfaced that's important. If you are interested in following and staying up to date on the legislation, Aaron Reed is the person that Jeff mentioned during the interview. And this is, what is this, their Instagram profile?
So she has a Substack where she updates. So she just said you can stay up to date on all the most important pieces of trans and queer news and legislation. It summarizes it with links and source documents. And she distills information from other places like TikTok and Twitter into like a whole digest. So you can follow her on Substack. Her name's Erin Reed, or her handles are Erin in the Morn on TikTok and Twitter. We'll link those in show notes, but I think that's a really great follow as well.
Good stuff.
And I think Point of Pride is on social, pointofpride.org.
Okay.
So please follow them too.
And while we're on things that we have done, just making sure that we're continually following up on stories that we've already done. There was an election, and it seems to have been a free and fair election in Panama, where Jose Raul Mulino won the presidency. And I think they've certified it. I'm not actually entirely sure, but it definitely has the votes to win the presidency. So Mulino took over the candidacy from Ricardo Martinelli, who is the former president of Panama, but is actually, I think, taking refuge in the Nicaraguan embassy because he is under indictment from the federal government for, I think, bribery charges. He was going to, he was running again, would have been the odds on favorite, but then, you know, obviously he's under indictment and can't run. So Molino, who was his finance minister, stepped up, who was the VP candidate for him. And then finance minister under Martinelli's administration was the VP candidate for Martinelli and then became the presidential candidate, has just won the election. It looks to be handily. The reason that's important is because there, Molino is running on a kind of a hardline stance. He's got two problems, but one of the central problems that he has is what to do with the Darien Gap. So the Darien Gap is where many Venezuelans are finding safe passage in particular. I shouldn't say safe passage. It's probably the biggest border crossing, and it's one of the pain points that the United States has in diplomatic relations with Venezuela and then with Panama, obviously, being in charge of that area. So that's where a lot of the border crossings are kind of originating from. And so he's looking to crack down on that, and that will have implications more broadly in Latin America. The other piece that he has to figure out somehow, and I don't know how he figures this out, but is the fact that there is water depletion in the Panama Canal, and it has impacted at various times of the year, severely curtailed the number of ships that can pass through it, which obviously has huge, huge implications on global trade. So going to be interesting to watch what the Molino presidency looks like down in Panama. And then, of course, coming up in, oh gosh, about 3 weeks, we have the election in Mexico to see who takes over. It, as we alluded to, it looks like Claudia Sheinbaum. It looks like she's going to carry the election pretty handily, basically projecting on her that she will be a continuation of Obrador's administration and policies. What's interesting about that is that it comes at a time when we might see the return of Trump presidency and how she stands up to that or doesn't. The increased role of the military, as Tad DeLay was talking about in our interview with him, and as has been written to us by a couple of unfuckers, that the increased role of the military is starting to make some observers, at least, kind of nervous. Oh, it wasn't Tad DeLay. It was Maureen Meyer from WOLA. Who made that point to us, that's something that I think a lot of international organizations are looking at. So a lot going on below the border, which, you know, as we get closer and closer to the election, the campus protests and the genocide in Gaza are going to be center stage right now. But as always, we sort of like have a short attention span in this country. You'll see, I think, some of the coverage begin to wane regarding Israel-Gaza as we get further and further into the summer. And you'll see economic issues and border issues begin to surface again more to the top of the news feeds. It is a prime tactic of Fox News to fearmonger about the border and potential invasions. And so it's really important to know what's happening on the other side of the border. And there you go. Before we get into some feedback and some emails directly, don't forget we are still in spring. So that means it is our fund, friend, and hell-raising period. Anything you can do to support the show, whether you're sharing us on social media, leaving us a 5-star review on the podcast app that you listen to, considering becoming a member so that you can access all of the additional resources that we have, or just letting us know who you are and communicating with us. Maybe it's joining the Facebook group for free. You can join the Unfuckers at All Facebook group and get into conversation with a lot of the core unfuckers that we talk to every day. You can sign up for the free weekly newsletter that we have so you can participate in that. Believe it or not, that helps us because if you get in touch with us and you even give us a comment or some feedback on the newsletter or some emails, it helps create more fodder for the show and more content. Helps us, you know, really identify who the audience is.
And we know what you want to hear about.
That's right. So all of these things are important. And if you can become a member, it really, really, really helps us with everything. So there you go. Now, let's get into some direct emails. 99 has curated from a bunch of comments and emails, some really, really insightful ones. So we're going to try to give them as much space as we can. Dan H. begins with a response to Over the Borderline Part 3. Putting on my devil's advocate hat to ask a question, make a critique of your conclusions. Love it. Your argument is that the U.S. used LAC countries mainly as a source of natural resources, raw materials, and cheap labor, and that most of our interventions were politically or ideologically motivated rather than to develop deeper economic partnership. However, If we had more fully included LEC countries as economic partners in the last 50 years, would that have precluded the U.S.'s ability to become the economic powerhouse it is today? It's a good question, number one. Or in other words, was this a zero-sum game that the U.S. won because we exploited LEC the way we did, and if we took your path, we may have lost? Again, this is not my take, but I can hear this argument a mile away as a reaction to your take on the U.S. behavior in the region. I'm curious to hear your response. So this gets into this Cold War mentality that we've had since the 40s, because prior to that, we really did look at it as a place to simply extract from and to overthrow and to coup. And even a lot of that was done at the behest of large corporations and deals that we were making on the side before we had very mature trade relationships. But this Cold War mentality precluded us from really making the type of investments that we could have and should have. And then in the 70s, we sort of tore down the wall with Communist China, which would have been the closest, I guess, machination of what we really view as communism. And while the Cold War was still raging, we had the detente starting in the Nixon era. And that continued, obviously, through Ford, through Carter, and then was really official through Reagan and the Bush years. And then it became the powerhouse beginning in the 90s. And I think you can see that trajectory pretty clearly. So it's like we suspended it because it was on the other side of the world. But if it was in our hemisphere, we kept a very strict interpretation of the Cold War mentality, as evidenced by the incursions into Guatemala, the incursions into Venezuela, disruptions of elections all over the place, overthrowing Salvador Allende when he came in with the socialist administration. I mean, that played out over and over. And of course, our obsession with Cuba. So the question at hand, though, is, okay, so if we dropped that pretense and partnered in the same way that we did with China, would we still have succeeded to the degree that we did? So what did we really get from China is the question at hand. And again, I have another statement at the end of this that's going to basically unravel everything that I'm about to say. But in pure, let's just say, realpolitik, maybe even Machiavellian economic terms, if we did in Latin America what we did in China, which was to kind of suspend ideology, partner with corporations there, even though we can't own them, that's the interesting part of this, and build supply chain networks, ports, help them invest in their own technology and their own infrastructure and their own manufacturing sector, could we have done that in Latin America? And the answer is, of course. The difference is we were dealing with one entity over there. The downside of that is, remember, the U.S. corporations that have a plant there, that have planted a flag there, they don't own those companies. So we have relationships and agreements with those manufacturing companies there, but we can't be there in the same way that a company that's public here can have places all over the world. So we could have done that in Latin America. We could have come up with a broad-based trade agreement with the whole region and brought people into it one by one instead of just isolating Mexico. When we went to Mexico and under NAFTA, we did not create any mature labor agreements and IP agreements and technology and performance agreements in the same way that the Chinese did. So we wound up simply going there to extract cheap labor for, let's say, additive measures to the supply chain, not original manufacturing, but adding things to the supply chain. So the good gets mostly done in China and then gets finished in places, or parts are added to it in places like Mexico, where the technology requirements aren't quite the same. But the abusive labor practices are essentially identical. It's just a question of who gets the bigger investment and who gets to hold on to more of the piece of the pie. So we decided to go with the neoliberal model of abusing the labor forces when and wherever we could, extracting natural resources, and if anybody put up a barrier to that, we'd simply overthrow you, instead of partnering with them in order to help both economies rise. There's an argument to be made that not only would it have been a more efficient, because of nearshoring, and ecological approach, because we wouldn't have the global trade infrastructure basically spewing into the environment with all of the pathways that we had to create, but it would have been more economically beneficial as a result of those two things. So, no, I reject that argument, and I think it would have been more beneficial to us, and it would have had better consequences for both the environment and for essentially bringing up the levels of poverty. Now, the downside to that is the neoliberal experiment that we had in Chile, where we did the same exact thing and we overthrew the government, partnered with that government, and then they went on a 20 to 25 year monetary stabilizing and economically increasing period. So outsiders will look at that and say, well, that worked. So neoliberalism is good. But the net result of that is that the poorest among the Chileans had very little agency in the increases and poverty. And so the most abject poverty was alleviated, but the inequality widened dramatically. Inequality is what eventually leads to instability. So it's not always about lifting people just out of poverty. It's also about managing inequality at the same time. That's why we argue for a new systems approach, or what Danny Bessner from the American Prestige would say, a more heterodox approach to foreign policy, where we recognize institutions are different in each country, resources, legal structures, and all those kind of things. But the three examples that Carol Wise gave in her book, I think, is a really good place to land. She talks about the post-Pinochet regime in Chile, Costa Rica, and Brazil, right? So those are her three main examples. And the argument that we made at the conclusion was that you've got a democratic socialist state, a liberal democracy, and one that really paid attention to environmentalism as the number one identifying factor of that country. In those three instances, they performed the best, they had the least inequality, they brought people out of poverty, and even though they were subject to the Dutch disease and resource curse in certain instances, which made them more prone to, let's say, commodity price shocks, overall, they were more stable and they had a more democratically socialist approach to undergirding the poorest among them. So that's where we landed with that. But again, it requires a new systems approach to thinking about trade, to thinking about the environment, and to thinking about equity. And in none of those situations can you have a planet that is largely driven by corporate interests. And that's kind of the lesson here. So thank you for that, Danny H. I really appreciate that question. So that's that on over the borderline. I think we can put that to rest. So why don't we get into some general feedback now?
Yeah, so we heard from Jesse T. So this is a fun little pop culture crossover into actual UNFTR content. So Jesse said, as soon as I heard Max mention Noah Gunderson in the episode, my ears perked up because he's been one of my absolute favorites artists. That's a new one. Since... I'm sorry. I'm melting down. Okay. As soon as I heard Max... Why has happened like once an episode now? I think it's something about this room.
Well, like, maybe part of it is having to shut the air conditioner.
It is too loud. Really hot in here now. I think I'm about to. It's like about to get bad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As soon as I heard Max mention Noah Gunderson in the episode, my ears perked up because he's been one of my absolute favorite artists since 2011. At the same time, I was excited to learn that someone else knew of him without me being the one to evangelize his music. I experienced a simultaneous and opposite impulse common to a lot of fandoms, gatekeeping. I felt a reflexive urge to discount Max's enjoyment of his music because he isn't up on all of the lore and the steady evolution of his sound and lyrical maturity. It was that classic moment of, you can't be a real fan unless you, and it was hard to separate myself from that feeling.
I grew up extremely conservative. I was raised as a straight white male. In my early 20s, I began to question a lot of what I'd formerly been taught, to deconstruct much of the toxicity of my upbringing. I found my way gradually to progressivism, and it was gradual. I went from thinking of myself as a conservative to center-right to moderate to center-left to progressive, and now I'm effectively ideologically aligned with democratic socialism.
But for much of that journey, I was siloed away from community because every time I tried to join a community, I felt attacked for not holding some ideological purity, as though they expected a kid with two decades of far-right indoctrination to immediately become a bleeding-heart liberal and socialist overnight. Because I held some views and had some blind spots, I didn't feel welcome in most lefty spaces.
And I feel like your podcast does a great job at welcoming people in this way. You're learning and growing and accepting of people on their own journeys. I wish I were able to contribute more to the unfucking community, but I just don't have the capacity right now. I do, however, listen to every episode, and I'm glad y'all are out there bringing this education to people who might just be able to hear it. Those on the far right aren't stupid. They're duped. And we win nothing by ideologically dunking on our political opponents. I'm really good with leaving that where it is because I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, you never know what's going to tee up some burst of inspiration.
Love it.
And we're glad to have you.
No doubt.
So next we heard from Ryan S., who said, why is that our Congress and AIPAC are not registered as agents of a foreign principle? The FARA Act of 1938 clearly defines what and who should be registered with the DOJ. With this Israel genocide that is taking place and the amount of pro-Israel propaganda coming out of Washington, one would think that AIPAC and those members of Congress are speaking on behalf of Israel to register with the DOJ.
So, Ryan, I want to hold this question because it's above my pay grade for two reasons. Number one is I don't know if there's been anything since the FARA Act to update that and clarify or alter any of the language. Number two, I'm increasingly hesitant to write declaratively about legal matters. And I think that that's a really good policy, to be frank. So one of the things that I've been doing is assembling a couple of questions in a separate document to have a legal expert kind of become hopefully a regular on the show. There have been a few suggestions, by the way, and I've reached out to a couple of people. There's one in particular that I would love to have in the mix, but I'm also kind of scouring universities and trying to think about if there are any law professors, like constitutional law professors out there that are available and also, kind of broadly versed in a lot of these issues that can speak on it in current context. So long way of saying, Ryan, that this is made it onto my sheet and, you know, I'd like to get some external validation for it because it's a really good question.
The law is so tricky and scary because it's like you can read something and it can say in plain letters something is legal or illegal. And then someone can be in clear violation of that, but still be legal.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, think about like tenants' rights and like the legalities of that where landlords routinely abuse things and don't get called for it or, you know, don't get charged for anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, yeah, it's hard. It's hard as a layman to interpret the law. And also, even when it feels user friendly, when you're like, oh, I can read this, I mm-hmm. can understand it. And then you're like, what do you mean? This is not what it means, or habeas corpus.
That's why there's law school.
What?
Yeah, that's why there's law school. That's
what,
why
like
people
got
to go to school for this shit. Yeah. And then, they have to take sit for the bar exam. That's the test that
mansplaining.
That's the test that RFK Jr. failed.
Oh,
yeah.
But you, what about Mike?
Eventually, he passed.
Mike from Suits. He knows everything about the law, and he didn't go. He didn't pass the bar himself.
Is that right?
Yeah. So that's the whole conceit: is that he's not actually like a real lawyer.
Oh,
yeah. But
because he couldn't pass the bar, or just didn't try.
He didn't go to Harvard. He used to pass the bar for other people, like he would take it for them. And then I didn't watch it. My sister watched it and I watched it vicariously during COVID.
OK,
so I'm just trying to appeal to the legal fans.
I think you're making a really good point about what most of us think we know about the law. And I'm being serious now. Like, people watch cop shows and then they watch legal shows and they get just enough bad information of cases that really have no basis in reality. And they're like, oh, well, this is how this is going to work out. The law, I tell you what, spend a little time in family court, which I've done, not for me, but if you go to family court, you will be partially horrified, astounded, afraid of getting caught up in the system. You want to talk about complicated law, about custody rights and marital issues and disputes and property and like...
Well, I know everything about that because they cover it on the Chicago series a lot. They're always doing DCFS.
Okay, so I should have carved that out.
Yeah, you should.
That out. My apologies. Yeah.
I mean, all entertainment law is confusing. Copyright law. All of it is, you know, even when I use images for the website and I'm like always really diligent about checking the copyright, but I'm like, this one's protected under CC 2.0, but this one's CC 2.2, but this one's CC 2.2 and 4.0. So does that mean it's okay?
Like every YouTuber is an expert on fair use.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Anybody that's ever been to a protest knows anything about free speech. it's just not the way it is. I remember my brain was breaking when we were doing the episodes on Holland Rakeen.
Mm.
I mean, because now you're talking about tribal rights and constitutional rights and states' rights.
It's like unprecedented. It's unprecedented territory.
It is indeed. So Sam Cedar is really good at this stuff. I think I've said that before on Majority Report. And I don't know what his background is. I know what his background is. I just don't know how he became so familiar with interpreting the law. But I do think it takes a specific brain. I really do.
Yeah. And also, you can talk to two lawyers and get different answers.
That's right. That's why there's courts. That's exactly right.
Because sometimes, look at the Weinstein thing.
Yeah, let's look at it.
I mean, was it sort of, did they make the right call? You know, question like, so it's just, I don't know, that it's almost like I don't even trust any of them because how do I know you're right? I mean, it's like anything.
Right.
You say one thing, a different podcaster says a completely conversely opposite. Or if it's conversely opposite, would that be the same?
I think that's inverse. Conversely opposite is just the inverse, no?
Yeah, I think so. I knew I was doing overkill. That's why I stopped. I added like three extra words that didn't need to be there. I'm just trying to be smart.
Hey, we got a book recommendation from Pete M. Book recommendation. I just listened to Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier as read by Frederick Davison. It's all good. And Orwell couldn't resist being amusing. But there's a particularly relevant to UNFTR section in the closing chapters in which he talked about the difficulties of slipping the idea of socialism past people's expectations and fears about it. Really smart, meeting people where they are ideas. Thought you would find utility. Shall we put that in our bookshop?
Of course.
Wonderful.
So then we heard from Angel L. So this goes a little bit to what you were talking about before. And Angel said, I've listened to you support Mexico's current centrist left government and their candidate as a good continuation of their current policies.
Not a good.
If you dug a little deeper, you might see that things are not as clear cut. You branded the other candidate, Xochitl Galvez, as a far-right ultra-conservative, and that's not accurate. The ruling party has put in place some social reforms, but have mostly followed the Trump playbook in the destruction of checks and balances to presidential power. I urge you to look deeper into what the ruling party, Morena, led by Obrador, has done in the last 6 years before expressing support for a party just because they brand themselves as leftists.
So I point taken, and I'm trying to be really careful about how I characterize Obrador. And it's interesting because it really does depend on the circle that you're in, as how you want to characterize it. And so I try to look at the output more than the actual statements. And remember, I got pushback from Elena because I had characterized Obrador as too close to the center at one point. And then Maureen from WOLA came on and said she's worried about the militaristic turn under Obrador specifically. And I think because the way I would characterize him is more like an Obama figure than a Bernie or a Lula and big conversations to have about Lula. But I don't feel like I've ever characterized Obrador as a leftist, as a pure leftist. I think where I started with him was center left, and I'm sort of landing in the middle right now. Because remember, he was willing and did play footsie with Trump the entire time. He never really denigrated the Trump administration. Not in the way, I mean, go back and read interviews or watch clips of Vicente Fox talking to and about George Bush. I mean, it was like, that was an aggressive Mexican president. It was wild. That's not Obrador. He's a statesman. He's a centrist. To me, he's an Obama figure who actually has some more social welfare policies that support the impoverished in Mexico than his predecessors did. But he did not crack down on the gangs and the cartels. It is still a violent nation. Mexico City has some issues with immigration from Americans. Like it depends on where you go in the country to see kind of what the circumstances are. So I didn't characterize this as a continuation. Like, oh, thank God it's a continuation of Obrador specifically, more so that at least Sheinbaum is not far right. So what I will dig into, Angel, you have my word on this, is what is Xochitl actually like? I don't All I know is position statements and how she's been framed in the media. So you have my word that I will do the work there. I promise.
And then I guess this goes to, I think, something that's upcoming. So on Professor Galloway, I used to listen to him in the past and agreed with some of his early views. As he's become more famous and rich, he's become more out of touch and clearly suffers from the Bill Maher effect. He workshops catchy phrases that he repeats incessantly as if they were the absolute truth. There was a clear break from when October 7th happened, where at first he was saying he was not qualified to share an opinion on what was happening. But after that, he's become more and more radicalized against anyone who protests against what is happening in Israel.
All right. So he's going to be a central character in our episode this weekend. And let me say this. I do not have a journey with Galloway other than being aware of him for a few years as a talking head on some news networks, as somebody who is in the marketing space, because that's, you know, that's something that 99 are familiar with in our day job. And he occupies a really interesting place. It's not the Bill Maher space, although I love that comparison because the trajectory is very similar from what I can tell. So I see him as more of like a Simon Sinek or Seth Godin type figure.
Okay. So more like bro influencer, but more professional.
Old professional bro influencer, like, you know, of a different kind of generation, not the young, like Leaders Andrew Tate last. Type, right?
No, yeah. I was thinking more on like, I think there's a spectrum. There's like the, from Simon Sinek, then you get a Gary Vee, and yes, then you get a Rogan,
yep,
and then you get a Tate. You know, there's maybe a Ferris in between.
Yes.
So there's a linear path there, but.
If they were all on a panel, you'd be like, oh.
Yeah, the white boys are in town.
Oh, okay. Right. So he entered my consciousness as somebody who had opinions on the world with the Carrot Swisher Pivot podcast. And I listened to a few of those and I was like, okay, again, establishment, liberal, regurgitation, Pod Save America type bullshit. Like, okay.
Shots fired.
No, they are what they are. They know what they are. I mean, they're the furthest thing from progressive. They're not even close. So they occupied that territory. But they do this, they do it in this, Swisher is a journalist and he's a professor, so they do it from an establishment liberal. What the fuck is that? That thing is...
It's like a kamikaze fly or a...
Shit.
Is it a wasp?
That's a fly.
Is he dead?
I think he's...
I genuinely think he crash landed and died.
He's unconscious, yeah.
You missed him doing a death spiral before. That's what I was laughing at.
The only reason I was going my coffee.
I thought he was going to fly right at your face.
I'm better that than my coffee. Anyway, so they came at it from this, like, in, I wonder if that was, if Pivot was actually a pandemic podcast, because I feel like there was a lot of that shit going on.
That's a good question.
Like, you know, UNFTR is an example starting during the pandemic. But so I feel like a lot of these people that had platforms in other places kind of came together, found Substack, found that, you know, and got a voice. And here's the interesting thing about this space, this thing that we do, is you got to stay in your lane. So every time I veer outside of my lane, I get in trouble. That's partially why 99 is here, is because, you know, she's the bumper in the side of the bowling lane, right? There are unfuckers out there that'll be like, what are you even talking about? Or can you maybe dig a little deeper into that? Because, you know, I don't think you have a full grasp of it. But the bigger you get, the more high profile you become. Now you're not just a professor at NYU who's on panels talking about marketing, but you're asked to weigh in on cultural items, and then culture leans into politics, and then so on and so on. Suddenly you have to be a subject matter expert across the board. Now, guys like Galloway are on the payroll. So the interview that we're going to share this weekend is from CNN. They're on the payroll. They get paid to do this stuff, right? There'll be a correspondent with, you know, the Universal Network, and they'll appear on these five programs, and they'll be on the shortlist for producers. Some people get paid for it. Others do it because they're always selling books, they're selling programs or whatever, but they're talking heads for, they're professional pundits. So Galloway went from professor to this sort of nominal marketing guru type thing into this cultural pundit talking on everything.
This is exactly what's happening to Huberman right now.
Oh, so thank you for saying that. Huberman is somebody that is completely not in my consciousness, but 99 and I were having conversations about him recently because I know he's in a lot of trouble and he has had some intersectionality with our like other day job world. So like, can you explain that trajectory? Because I think it's really important to understand.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is just a general, this, and I will at top plug Conspirituality, which I've talked about before. They cover this industry really well. It wouldn't shock me if they've talked about Galloway before. I'll have to do a search in their feed. But basically, he's a scientist and he...
A social scientist?
No. He is...
hard science scientist?
Like, in the middle, like, I think more, he's a neuroscientist. So he's not doing experiments on brains, directly. He's not in the lab working in the same way. I mean, I'm sure he's done lab.
But like a research scientist in neurology.
More that like kind that. So he started that way. He had Huberman Lab or has, it's a kind of an open question mark, gave him some credibility. I'm not doubting any of his credentials, but he started this podcast called the Huberman Lab, the Huberman Lab, named after the actual lab at Stanford. And, you know, at first it was talking about science and it was talking about these things and, you know, okay, talking about this and your brain can do this and look at the sun when you wake up because whatever. And then it was like, okay, then it starts getting very Rogan-y where now I'm telling you this thing and now I'm telling you that thing and it's completely outside of his wheelhouse. So the Conspirituality guys, have, you know, talk about that. And that's one of their biggest critiques of anybody is when somebody starts talking outside and you already trust this person because they've taught you what they know about their subject. So why wouldn't they know about this? And also, I'm not saying everyone, how do I put this? Not everyone's discerning enough to think about just because he's a scientist doesn't mean he's science. He's not Bill Nye the Science Guy. You know, he knows about one thing, just like I might have studied graphic design, but I'm not a textile expert, so I can't tell you about that. You know, like I might know a thing or two about it, but that's about it. That's being a well-rounded human, but not an expert. And so
one of his recent podcast episodes is titled How to Master the Growth Mindset. That to me tells you everything you need to know.
He has all of these like insidious, basically his whole thing is what Conspirituality again calls like these bro science guys. So are Rogan, so him. There's so many other guys that I can't even list. Like they all meld together for me. You know, Russell Brand is in the mix because he decided that he's, you know, a pseudo philosopher and could talk about these things. Now he's a Christian. So I think he posted a video was like 1 week into Christianity and I feel so great. Like something like that. So they all weirdly, they all have Conspirituality. Again, I'm shilling for them hardcore. They do not pay me, but if you want me to do it, I'll take your money.
Yeah.
they did an episode about all of these guys turns into Christianity. It's very weird because, well, if I'm optimizing my body and my mind, why shouldn't I optimize my soul with God? So, and it just adds a weird shine onto
Jordan
everything.
Jordan Peterson.
Yes, exactly. But so Huberman's whole thing is about body optimization, all of them. So, you know, hacking your brain, making sure you sleep. You don't need that much sleep, but, you know, drink a lot of water. Some of the stuff is just normal advice, but some of it is like take AG1, Athletic Greens, which is that protein supplement, you know, whatever shake that has a bunch of shit in it isn't FDA approved because none of it is. And they shill for it and act like it's going to cure you of whatever you have. Anyway, so he always just gave me the ick because I, you know, my bullshit tolerance for that is very extremely low, probably unreasonably low, because once I get a whiff of bro influencer, I'm out. You know, even if you veer into that territory, I'm like, don't do it.
Well, I think this is some really valid stuff. So you've got, these are past episodes.
Okay.
Neuralink.
Okay, perfect.
Building better brains.
Love Elon Musk.
Yeah. Psilocybin.
Perfect. Okay, I'll take that one.
There you go. Benefits and risks. Psychedelics for mental health.
They love microdosing. The community loves microdosing.
Yeah. A lot of virility stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Well, that's part of optimizing
again.
Your body.
It's the second one on that. Goals. Just goal setting.
Just goals.
Right? Which
hashtag
is really
goals.
Important. Yep. Roadmaps for success. Anyway.
And so anyway, the big takedown, there is a takedown of Huberman. sure he's barely seen anything from it. He's probably lost some fans, but most people, they don't care. He was exposed because he was entertaining a relationship with six women who all thought they were exclusive with him, who were all having unprotected sex because he told them they were exclusive.
Six
that went on record.
I got to go back and listen to the virility podcast. This guy's doing something right.
But, you know, the whole thing is about optimizing your mind, your body, your life, and, you know, being clear and all of this stuff, not in the Scientology way, but here he is just living a fake life, telling all of these women we're exclusive, I love you, all this stuff. Like the scheduling he had was like, it would be like breakfast with woman one, texting with woman two at the same time, picking woman three up from the airport, dropping her off. Woman five is watching my dog right now, so I'll go see her later. And then, you know, fucking woman six in the car or something. Obviously, wow. It's hyperbolic, but to the schedule, to the moment. So this whole thing, your whole shtick is about optimizing your life. This is what you've done, chosen to optimize.
You're actually lending a lot of credence to this.
I suppose, but yeah. if you're so enlightened and so, you know, unburdened of your drama and your trauma and your body baggage and blah, 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 and then this is the type of shit you pull. So it is just always good, especially with anybody who becomes an influencer, whatever level they are, whether it's micro-influencer, if it's Instagram, TikTok, you know, influencers who come to power through LinkedIn. I mean, and then they end up on your TV for some reason. Then they're at a seminar and then they show up at a conference and then they have a book. Now that they have a podcast, so they're in your ear every day. That stuff seeps in. And just because they have an expertise in something does not mean they're an expert in everything.
Right. And there is Scott Galloway in this moment. So thank you. That is exactly what I was hoping you would do.
You know, I can get real riled up about that stuff.
I love it. So we're going to talk about a couple of things, really only two things. We're going to talk about campus protests and the overlap with anti-Semitism and have what I hope will be an important conversation about both of those things. But I want to do it through the lens of I don't even know what to call it. Lazy, ahistorical, just factually and culturally illiterate, manufactured consent that is what Galloway put forward. And I'm only picking, there's 1,000 really shitty takes you can take. And people have sent me a lot of them. His, I think, hit a nerve with me because of that crossover. Who the fuck is this guy? Why is he in this prime slot explaining this thing? And it is in complete opposition to where, as a shepherd of young minds in the position of professor, first and foremost, where he cut his teeth. It is in such dramatic opposition to that responsibility, what he says. And it's that type of behavior and those type of words from those type of people that supports these really bad narratives. And so I want to talk about it. And through that lens, yes, it's a hit piece, but it's a hit piece because we need to show what manufactured consent really looks like, what propaganda sounds like, because it's also his presentation. Because he is a learned person, I presume a pretty fucking awesome professor. My guess is, like, if you were in a class with this guy and you were in a lecture, you'd be like, I'm not missing that one. I love this guy. He's rational. He's warm. He's seems to have a lot of facts at his fingertips. And he does it in this sort of like folksy, but not patronizing folksy kind of way. Like, gosh darn, it's really, you know, I feel for them. But now here's all the reasons that we should let the cops beat the fuck out of them, kind of way. And it's dangerous.
Also, as a professor, you know, the last thing, you think he would be pro students.
Of course.
So that's not the guy I want teaching me anymore.
And that's why he was perfect. That's why he's perfect for that role.
Right.
If you want to manufacture consent. So we're going to do that.
And it's not even, I guess, I think calling it a hit piece is even a bridge too far because it's not about him. He's the vehicle.
Well, you see, I have no problem hitting a Tucker, hitting a Jesse Waters, hitting a Joe Scarborough, or even like a Matt Taibbi or a Greenwald or whatever, like, this is your take. This is your thing. You say you studied it. You stand for this. You're paid for this. Like, okay, let's fucking get after it, right? That all's fair in love and journalism. He occupies a different position in society, in my opinion. And also, I believe, either should know better, but probably knows better. And so he's doing this for some nefarious reason. And it could simply be that he is a fervent Zionist. I don't know.
Or this is his moment.
But this is a man who, according to Angel, said, you know, had no opinion on the matter as early as October. Didn't feel qualified to speak on it. And now is speaking with such authority on the subject that he's basically leaning into every single bad counter-protest narrative that you could possibly do in one small segment. So I'm excited to disassemble.
It's a very odd to say, if you were a Zionist, the moment Israel was attacked, you would perk up and go, oh, I'm against that because I love Jews and Israel. But to be like, I don't know anything, it's almost like someone else is like pulling the strings or something.
It could be that, or it goes back to the, like, where we started the whole conversation. What conversations are people having? Those are important too. Like, there's what everybody learns, but then there's what you encounter every day. And, you know, in his world, so now let's project on him and try to imagine like the motivation. He's in elite circles.
Right. I was going to say.
In New York City, in academia and media, and getting paid a lot of money to do all of those things as a book publisher and as a podcaster. And I think he's got a lot at stake.
And if we've learned anything throughout this last 7 months is that the academia is not safe. It's not safe for people.
It's not what people think it is.
No, that's it's not right. People. There, it's not freedom of speech and freedom of thought.
It's not a pillar of the liberal establishment either, which we're also going to talk about.
Yeah, especially at these private universities. I mean, I guess, did we ever think they were safe? But, you know, the idealized campus with tables everywhere for whatever, and you pick whatever interest you're in, that doesn't exist in the way. Everything is filtered through their corporate lens, essentially, because they are corporations unto themselves.
You bet.
Just little fucking fuckers.
Yeah, and their trustees become slaves to the endowment. That's really what it all comes down to. You know, that's, anyway. All great points raised across the board. Loving this episode. So just to get to a few closing thoughts here, we've got Brian B., who said, I heard a great interview on Doug Henwood's podcast, Behind the News, with Adam Fetterman on the criminalization of dissent. I looked into New York's situation, and there is A8334 and a few others. All three are terrible, but A8951 treats protesters who block traffic as, quote, domestic terrorists. I can envision a show on dissent throughout our history and how those who dissented were always a minority and always castigated by mainstream media. See MLK and the Vietnam War and Eugene Debs, my hero. That's Brian saying that, but he's also mine. On World War I, to name two. Keep up the great work. Once again, so this weekend we're going to talk about a lot of this, but we're not going to go down very specific legal roads because
law is hard.
Law is hard. Enforcement is subjective, tends to be racialized.
What?
Certainly hierarchical.
No, stop right there. What do you mean?
What I'm saying is that you, walking through this world, as a white woman,
yes, as I
who clearly
previously
loves your privilege, as you said, you're fine.
Thank God.
But yeah, we will touch on it, Brian B., and I'm sure that we'll have more expansive episodes in the future.
Yeah, and then lastly, this is just a good shout out to a local unfucker. We're not local to us, but local in this community doing the good work. So Cody Rodin said, I'm the facilities manager of Highland Lakes Canine Rescue in Marble Falls, Texas. We are 100% no-kill dog rescue and a 501c3 nonprofit. We focus on medical, behavioral, and abandoned dogs. We get our dogs from partnering with other kennels from kill shelters in the area. We rescue, rehabilitate, and rehome an average of 300 dogs per year. Not huge numbers, but when you consider every dog we adopt out, opened a bed in a city shelter with a number that can be doubled. We also partner with Canines for Warriors out of San Antonio to provide PTSD service dogs to wounded veterans. So we do have people come from all over the world to adopt from us. And since we don't pass on the vet bills to the adopters, it makes us pretty popular with out-of-staters that can't find their forever friend locally. So Cody's just asking for a shout out, and I'm here to facilitate. That was all aligned with my beliefs. Obviously, I love animals. Doggies are important, but for other animals too, just reminding you, other animals are important too. But we're talking about dogs, so stay on track, 99. So they have a live Facebook event coming up on May 15th. And it's called Jordan's Way. I looked it up. I think that is an influencer. Funny we should mention, but an animal, or at least a dog rights influencer. So they're partnering with this person to do a fundraiser. So, you know, join into the live stream on May 15th. Check out their Facebook, or they can go to the website where you can donate. So it's hlcr.org. So if you're, you know, I know some of our unfuckers are plant fuckers or just people who love animals, so this is so you know it's going to the right place since we know somewhere in there.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it. Did you see the Christine Ohm thing?
Yeah.
What the fuck? Who kills a dog?
The crazy that you should care about the dog because we kill pigs every day and pigs are smarter than dogs.
Pigs are not smart.
They are.
Okay. Pigs.
Pigs.
Pigs are delicious.
Ugh.
Sorry.
Disgusting. I genuinely want to know this. I know this is going to be radical to people. Maybe, but it's like, think about how fucking upset you are that she killed one dog.
And a goat.
Okay. Why do people care that they killed a goat? People eat goat. We take goat milk. We essentially enslave them.
Goats. Justice for cricket.
Of course. Well, justice for all of the animals who are killed every second of every day. Like, I implore you. Listen to me. When you're going night-night, just think about your furry friend. Think about how much you love them. And then think about why you care so fucking much that someone else's furry friend was killed when all my furry friends are killed all the time.
Objectively. I'm being totally honest right now. I love you. I think you are hitting on one of the most, like, extreme examples of cognitive dissonance. I really do.
Why? Because you think that dogs are greater or superior to pigs?
I'm saying you're right.
Oh, I thought you were yelling at me.
Collectively.
Sorry. I thought you were saying I was experiencing. I set it up that way
because I wanted to upset you and then bring you back.
Okay. I just got confused.
I think you're right. I really do. I think that it is, we have bifurcated and compartmentalized that piece of our brain and completely normalized the house pet versus the eat pet. And it's like, every time I see the Instagram reel of an adorable cow, I'm like, these cows are amazing. Cows are so fucking cute.
They're brilliant.
Easy. If they were brilliant, they'd drive. But they're beautiful. They're awesome and they're cute and so just neat. And it's like, oh, I'm glad they saved that one, you know. And then I'll go have a burger. It is the most extreme form of cognitive dissonance imaginable.
To get on my soapbox further.
Go for it.
My mom for years would talk about the dog festival in South Korea and how every year they had the dog festival, which I believe they've since made illegal, where they would like eat dogs. This isn't racist lore. They had a festival there. It has a specific name. Let me see what it's called.
I believe you.
I know, but I want to make sure I'm not saying anything bad. Yeah, because I'm already...
I think you are.
Okay.
You probably.
So...
I mean, you started this whole episode being like, thank God I'm white.
Sambok, or the Dog Days of Summer, covers a month of time, the peak of the growing season and traditional time to some South Koreans. It's classified as a traditional time to cool off and extract some medicinal healing powers from the consumption of dog meat. So, yes, they made it illegal now. So there's a lot of people who every year would get upset about the dog festival because how could you eat dogs? It's disgusting, barbaric, you know, also racist. Some of the conjecture around it was racist because, you know, uncivilized for them to eat dog, even though we eat plenty of animals. So my mom would get mad at me every year. And I just remember having we had one conversation about it, and it was the last time she brought it up to me. Because she was complaining about it. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't listen to you talk about this because you eat meat. And what is the fucking difference? What is the difference? And, you know, we had that ongoing conversation for years. And then we had that one and we probably didn't talk about it again. And then one day my mom said, you know, you're right. This entire time, I'm wrong. And right or wrong is so, that's such a difficult, you know, language to use in this kind of situation. But she was like, I don't want to eat meat anymore. You're right. I love animals. I've always said I've loved animals, and how hypocritical of me to eat meat when I love animals. And so she stopped eating meat. She went vegan not long after. It's been probably almost a decade at this point. But, you know, it's like you have to really, really examine what we've created, that it's okay to eat some animals and not others. Like at that point, if you're going to say it's okay to eat animals, you should be absolutely fine with people eating dogs. If she killed that dog and ate it, would it have been better? Would it have? Just wondering, did she eat the goat? Is that okay? So I don't know. It's just very frustrating. And it's one of those things that I, you know, besides like the, oh, vegan, how do you know someone's vegan? Like that joke, people just get very, they get
Wait,
so.
What's the punchline?
Because they tell you. Yeah. Which is, you know, like I've said before, if I try not to tell people because I just don't want to fucking talk about it with them, because I don't want to have them go, what do you mean you don't eat meat? Why don't you eat meat? What do you mean you can't eat meat? What do you mean? Like, I don't want that. If someone is engaging me honestly and wants to know more about it, I'm happy to tell them. And I don't sugarcoat it. I tell them about factory farming and I say, this is why. And I think this is inhumane and I love animals and I think they have every right to live. I'll tell them all that. But something like this, when you confront someone, you just get shut down. We get called radical, you know?
Right.
When there's a huge movement of feminism where vegan feminists believe that it is not feminism if you eat animals, because we should be protecting all like feminine lives, including, I mean, if we think about what happens to cows, is we forcibly impregnate them so they can produce milk, and then we rip their babies away to make veal or for slaughter or to become, you know, more dairy cows. And does that, if we were doing that with people, would that seem feminist to you to make a baby farm? And you think about also puppy mills, like all of these things, that it's rape culture. I mean, I know that's going to piss people off because they think animals are less than, but there's a whole movement of vegan feminism that feels this way. And anytime like I see it get posted on Reddit in a feminism forum or something, it's just completely like we're made out to be crazy that we believe that feminine animal lives should also be valued. So it's really difficult because, you know, you just go through it every day. Like you live, you have this, to me, I feel, I'm going to say something controversial. I feel like I have an elevated consciousness because I don't eat meat. I feel like that's how I feel about it. And I know that might sound really fucked up, but I just feel like it is, I feel elevated in, not in a morally superior way, but I just feel like I'm more in touch with our environment and our life cycle because of this. And I want everyone to be. So it's not a gatekeeping thing where I'm like, I'm better than you because of this. I want everyone to be this in touch and value animal life. So no, it's a long tangent on something that was completely unrelated, but
it's not at all unrelated.
Well, we weren't talking about veganism really.
No, but when we did the climate industrial complex episode and the vegans will save us all episode, we basically landed in the same place, which is if we do not completely transform the way that the world eats, completely shift the balance at a minimum from the 70-30 that it is now from protein consumption versus vegetation. If we don't completely flip that balance, we could do all of the other climate remediation measures that we want, and we'll never find that equilibrium that Tad DeLay was talking about. We'll never hit the IPCC target. We just won't.
Yeah.
Period. And it's the single most important thing. It's the single most empowering thing that we all have.
It's the choice you can make that actually, you know, most people can't really choose whether or not they drive to work. You probably can't get there on public transportation. Like realistically, you know, if you live in a city, yes. Like where I grew up, I couldn't take the train to work. Like I couldn't get here from where I grew up. So
that you couldn't get here today.
Truly. So yeah, I was in a lot of traffic today. But there's, you know, we can't, sure, if you work 15 minutes away, you can choose to bike to work. Okay, that's a great choice that you're making, and that's, you should be proud of that. But like reducing your carbon footprint and your impact, like this is truly extremely tangible. And then they'll go, well, what about all the soy crops? Hey, most of the soy crops that are grown are to feed animals. Like that's a fact. There are so many things where people, you know, I could so easily just go like, and this, and this, and this, and they'd still just We're superior. What do you mean? We're on the top of the food chain. Well, that's what other animals do. It's like that video that one of our unfuckers sent us where, what did he say? Dogs sniff each other's butts when they see each other.
Right.
And we don't do that. Should we do that? You don't eat lions, or, you know, your jaw doesn't go the same way lions' jaws go, because, like, it's just all, even just cutting down on your dairy consumption. Not only is it good for you, dairy is not healthy for you. That is, there's so much propaganda. I mean, God, could we fuck Big Milk one day? Whew. I mean, we'd probably get cease and desists from the dairy farmers. Like, that's one thing about Vermont, funny enough, and even Bernie, is that because it's such big farming land, they have to sort of be in bed with the dairy industry. So that's one thing I don't love. Even like the you mentioned the governor of Vermont, it's like he's like Democratic, but very pro farmers, which it's an interesting conversation. We do need farmers, but then you get into the dairy farmers and you get into the government and the lobbying group. It is like one of those threads that is almost as wild to pull on as like the evangelical controls in society, is how much these types of lobbying groups have power on like our jobs, what we eat, all of the above. But I don't know. Yeah, it's just,
well, there's one thing that we cannot stop as a people.
Me?
As humans.
Talking about this?
No, we can't stop eating.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And now there's 8 billion of us. And so when we talk about unwinding and unraveling capitalist structures, there will be no industry. And I'm saying industry, but the industry that covers fishing to...
there's going to be no fish
for farming to, you know, everything, and protein manufacture, everything that goes into the food supply chain. There's no industry that is as intertwined with our lives, our media, culture, our very existence, our economy. I mean, it touches all of them. And it would be the single hardest thing to unwind. And at the same time, it is the place where you can have, where it's the thing that we could do. So like, even defossilizing this entire economy, if we did it like that, it would bring everything to its knees, right? If we did the same thing in protein industry, it would also bring the economy to its knees. But it's the only thing that could be rebuilt back where it would serve extending human life, extending the planet's life, extending capitalism, even, right? Extending, you know, economic fortitude and wherewithal of certain economies. It would be an amazing thing for human existence.
Yeah. And then, I mean, like, I can just see the arguments coming in. Well, you know, artificial meat's not good for you. Neither is regular meat. Okay. You know, well, aren't they using as much manufacturing power? No, they're not. It's just, they're simply not. Well, the animals, just, we got to kill them. There'll be too many animals. It'll take care of itself, essentially. I'm not gonna, like, a population expert, so I can't give you the, you know, it's that one is a really big moral gray area for me, like people who population control among like deer and that type of thing. Like, I don't have the answer to that. I don't want them to die. I don't have the answer to deer overpopulation. So like, when it comes to this, we also just wouldn't need as many cows, you know, to use the cow example. Like, if we were eating less meat, we wouldn't need to make as many fucking cows. The cows aren't in the wild fucking, you know, there are some, obviously, but the cows that you're seeing, the black and white cows with the little tag on their ear, they're not just fucking naturally. We're impregnating them. So we could just stop impregnating them and we'd have less cows.
So I have seen that up close.
Cow impregnation?
Cow insemination.
Why? In person?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Not important, but I've been in the barn when I've watched it happen.
Who are you?
It's fucking wild.
Yeah, you gotta put your thing in its ussy. Mm-hmm. It's cow ussy.
All the way in there.
And then you gotta jerk off the bulls?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's someone's job. Someone's job is to jerk off animals.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that sick? Why do we have that?
Mm.
Let's not have that anymore. Unless we're trying to, like, save an animal species and jerking it off is, like, good for humankind or animal kind.
Mm-hmm.
Again, why do we care about endangered species? Let them all fucking die. I mean, if you're going to just kill other species, why is a panda greater than a regular bear? Not that we eat bears, but some people might. I don't know.
You know what? Fuck cricket.
Yeah, the dog deserved to die.
Obviously. The argument being it was untrainable.
Of course. Yeah, naturally.
I think I would like to leave it on
Actually, I just, well, those can't be my last words on my animal rights spiel, is that naturally the dog deserved to die.
No, we can.
I know that we're being facetious, but.
Of course. But I would like to leave it on. Jerking off a bull is somebody's job. How about we don't? I love that.
Put it on a t-shirt.
But we do have to thank Sloppy Joe and Hot Scott.
Hot Scott. Look at the time.
For becoming members. Appreciate you. Thank you, everybody, for hanging with us today. We know it was a long one. There's a lot of good stuff in there. As always, you know, it just is evidence that we have the best and smartest audience in the world.
We also have a lot of thoughts in these little brains of ours.
Some.
I think this is maybe the record for rants for me today.
I'm here for it.
And relevant rants.
I'm here for
it. So everyone can put their knives away. I'm on point today, babe.
Let me see if it's going to take me the balance of the day to get her back in the bottle, boy. I'll tell you that much. She's ready to go. Thanks, everybody. Manny, thank you. And we'll see you this weekend, unfuckers.
Bye.